Christian Parenting.
Welcome to the Living Wholehearted Podcast. We are Jeff and Tara Mattson, a husband and wife team who is shrinking the integrity gap in our own lives and helping others do the same. I'm a leadership and organizational development coach, and Tara is a licensed marriage and family therapist.
We believe that if you have a following, you are a leader, and how you lead matters. Whether you are leading in the home, work, or community, we are bringing you biblical, clinical, and relational wisdom to help you in every relationship that matters most to you. None of us do this perfectly, but we are leaning into the reality of our humanity and profound wisdom of grace. Your biological clock is ticking. You'll regret not having kids. Well, any woman who even hints she is maybe questioning whether or not she wants to have kids has heard some sort of these cultural scripts. Our guest today asks, is it possible to do something more meaningful than mothering? Hint, the answer is yes. The conversation today is for anyone, whether a mom or a non-mom, a step-parent or a foster parent, an infertility or an ambivalent who's been shamed, in particular by American Christianity, for not feeling what they're supposed to feel about motherhood.
Our guest for this episode is Erin S. Lane, a writer, theologian, and someone other than a mother. She is the author of Someone Other Than a Mother, Flipping the Scripts on a Woman's Purpose and Making Meaning Beyond Motherhood. She holds a bachelor's degree from Davidson College and a master's degree from Duke Divinity School, both with a focus on gender studies. Mentored by Parker J. Palmer and the Center for Courage and Renewal, she works as a vocational retreat facilitator, helping people discern their wildest questions of purpose.
Well, it's so good to have you with us today, Erin. This is going to be a fantastic conversation. At Living Wholehearted, we really believe that our stories matter and they're influencing for the good and for the not so good, why we do what we do as leaders. Talk about your story and how it influenced you writing the book, Someone Other Than a Mother.
So I wholeheartedly believe that what we celebrate matters. And I was never celebrated so much as when I became officially, legally recognizable as a parent. And this perhaps wouldn't have been so destabilizing for me if I had not been purposefully, prayerfully child-free for 10 years prior. So I grew up in the American Midwest on white bread and Jesus. I was Catholic. I was kind of steeped in a lot of the messages that a young Catholic girl gets. So there were two options for a life well-lived I was given as a young Catholic girl. One was mother. I could marry a man and make my own babies. Or mother superior, which is really, I could marry God, so to speak, and mother the world's children. And both are good outcomes for someone's life. Just neither of those felt like they really fit who I was called to be in the world. And so for years, I was really wrestling with what did it mean to have faith in a God who did not seem as compelled by mother love as other love. And yet the churches and communities and relationships I was in sometimes made me feel like there was something wrong with me for wanting to devote myself to a improbable family rather than making family of my own. And really that mother identity just never felt like something I had a lot of imagination for. I also didn't have a lot of imagination to be like an air traffic control operator, but that wasn't like, you know, so alarming to people, right? So there was like this very like strong pull, it felt like, from my community to mother on top of whatever else I did. And it wasn't until I met a partner who felt similarly. We sort of dedicated ourselves to, okay, I think we're just going to be really great community members. And this is going to be part of how we do our work in the world. Led us to fostering, not necessarily because we wanted to be replacement parents, but because we wanted to be good neighbors. And then very unexpectedly, much quicker than we had been told often happens. The children under our care, their parents' rights were terminated. We were given the option of, do you want to become these people's forever home, or do you want to help them find home with another family? And for reasons I can still hardly explain, we were more compelled by the yeses than the noes. And that is how we became a unit. But it was a very different story than the one I had often heard from a lot of other women growing up, about this idea of always wanting to be a mother, always wanting to, quote, have children of your own. I'm still not sure I understand exactly what that means. And really wanting to cultivate like a little unit unto yourselves. And that just was, my husband and I had very different commitments going into it. So I wrote this book trying to celebrate some of the under-celebrated parts of the church, some of the under-celebrated parts of our family members and our friends, some of the people who are like the most spectacular people in our communities, but because they don't have biological children or because they don't look like parents in the way that the rest of our community might, they often feel like they get the short shift.
Which is really the heart of Jesus at the core, when you think about him always seeing the people that no one else is seeing. And so you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, there's probably a cultural piece from just where you were living in America, in the Midwest, but probably in different parts of the U.S. that's stronger messages. That to be a mother is your main identity. What's wrong with you if that's not really the direction you want to go? And then there's a Christian undertone, you're saying, in the church. So maybe give us one example of a more covert way that you felt like you weren't celebrated because you weren't a mom. Just so that the audience is wrapping their mind around, because I can see a lot of people going, well, of course, we're more than just mothers. But I do get what you're saying, and I would love a little more of a tangible example so people can kind of track with you more.
Sure. So the book is organized into 9 different shoulda scripts, or scripts that women have been handed, pervasive cultural sayings. So those scripts are really naming the problem. Your biological clock is ticking, home is your highest duty, motherhood is the toughest job in the world, it'll be different with your own, you'll regret not having kids, family is your greatest legacy, right? There are these things that we say, even though you're right, on the one hand, we're like, well, of course women are more than their reproductive roles. But then we have all these insidious scripts that actually serve to shame women who aren't making motherhood their primary identity, and then can put a lot of pressure on women who do feel like it might be their offering, their calling, their purpose in the world. It can make them feel like, oh gosh, though, if this isn't the thing I'm investing in at all hours of the day, then what's wrong with me for not measuring up? What's wrong with me for feeling a little bit ambivalent sometimes about it? What's wrong with me, right, for not celebrating this about myself in the way that, like, culturally and perhaps religiously I'm getting elsewhere? So I think one of the scripts that does that, shows that connection the clearest, is home is your highest duty. And I joke that not a lot of people go around saying that these days. I feel like we have like a much more nuanced view of women and work, and that that can happen in a paid way, and that can happen in an unpaid way, and that can happen in your home, and that can happen in an office. And after the pandemic, it can happen in your pajamas in any number of places, right? but this idea is deeper than just this dutiful idea of motherhood. It's that, like, what happens under your own roof is going to be your best and most beautiful offering. And so there is a long history of that message, both coming from American politicians. So Teddy Roosevelt is the best example. He gives this infamous speech to the National Congress of Mothers, who later becomes the PTA. So we can see like these long legs of this kind of rhetoric, and essentially says, yes, like, motherhood is going to be the best thing you do, not only for God, but for your nation. Like, this is going to be how you contribute. And if you don't contribute in this way, you are shirking your God-given duty to country, and church. And again, while we don't say that explicitly these days, I do think there's this idea that like family comes first. Oh, interesting. All the time? Are there some times when like you might actually have to say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to make it home for dinner at 6 o'clock tonight because there are some friends who actually really require my deep presence? Or actually, like I got caught up with a stranger who has a story that feels really important and you're going to be okay nuking mac and cheese back at home, right? Like, I mean, even just going into, you know, your Michael's or Target, there are all of these messages in beautiful calligraphy about our homes being the place where the deepest, most beautiful work happens. And again, it very well might be, but this idea that it always comes first, it is the primary way you should want to contribute, and that it's a very feminine way, right, of doing your purposeful calling in the world. And yeah, there's a lot of shade and shame for people who don't organize their life in that way, whether moms or non-moms. So I think that even though sometimes as I talk about this idea, people are like, does anyone really think like that's all women are good for, motherhood? No, I don't. I think very few people do. But we have, again, all of these pervasive cultural sayings that are pretty insidious about inserting, yeah, family comes first. Okay, what is that? Mm. What does that mean then? What does that mean for me then? If I have other commitments, other Christian commitments, other vocational commitments, other relational commitments, what am I supposed to do with those?
Erin, I love the way you're challenging those cultural norms that we just can easily swallow, absorb in our lives and over decades. I'm kind of resistant to signs in stores like this. Anyway, I mean, my wife, she buys a lot of signs.
I'm not. I buy them.
Tell me what to do. These signs, they tell me what to do. I'm fundamentally against signs like this.
Let's talk about that for a
minute. But I appreciate the fact that you're drawing some memory to me a little bit about kind of our cultural and Christian, Western Christian kind of norms and just sort of what churches in general, a lot of churches just sort of and denominations have propagated. And there's another comparison here. I wonder if you would speak to it a little bit, which is, you know, the comparison of elevating marriage versus singleness, right? And the scriptures talk a lot about this, and Paul has some things to say about what might even be better. And we've seen the church in our limited sphere, if you will, address that, kind of turn towards that, make some headway and some ground for elevating singleness and the beauty and the things that can come from being single and helping married folk to have empathy, understanding, and also practically integrating singles in couples and mixed generation groups and what have you. This is a different comparison, but I'm just drawing some things that relate to that I think the church has gone through, and you're pulling this out, which I think has some similarities and health for us, especially as followers of Christ and in the church, to have more awareness of. Speak to some of that.
I am a theologian by training, and also a theological anthropologist, which just means I nerd out on studying what humans think about God. And one of the most fascinating paradoxes to me is Christianity is this religion that grew out of a very strong, you could argue, critique of marriage and children. At least to your point, Paul thought it was a viable, if not concessionary, option for those who couldn't quell their desire elsewhere. And yet, in modern American Christianity, it is typically Christians who hold what we call traditional family values. We get associated with that, at least, which means we are the marriage and family values people. And I nerd out a little bit in the book, mm-hmm. in the chapter, children are a gift from God, which I don't dispute, but this idea that procreation or sex should always lead to procreation, and that sex for the purpose of pleasure is not allowable, is very rife in the stigma we have against people who are married or coupled and still decide to be childless or child-free or make unlikely families. So it is in the waters we swim in. And yet it's a very recent development in human history, if you want to call like the last 500 years recent. But really for the first 1500 years of church history, it was a minority opinion that marriage and children were an equally faithful way of living out the Christian gospel. Now, I'm not arguing that was the right opinion, but again, how good for us to have some intellectual humility and remember that some of the things we hold dearest to us, the early church would have had some questions about. And likewise, you know, we're still wrestling with how to make sense of this ancient text in a way that maps out onto our modern sensibilities and what we know to be true about sex and gender and all sorts of different things now. So I agree that the church has, in my adulthood, come some way in accepting single people as full flourishing members in the life of the church. My hope is that they would continue to do that for childless, child-free, and unlikely families. Because again, the real irony is I think Jesus was pretty adamant that it's not a belonging by biology, but a belonging by baptism that is actually the kind of kingdom he came to usher in. And so when we put so much time and attention and effort into making and resourcing and elevating the biological family above all else, I really think we're getting off track from the much more creative, expansive, imaginative community that Jesus and the early church had in mind for us, in which I would argue friendship was one of the highest forms of love. Jesus says there's no greater love than that person who would lay their life down for a friend. He doesn't say that about motherhood. He has some like very weird sayings.
he does.
And very harsh things to say to his own mother. So it's just so interesting how we have really gotten some of our commitments and our emphases wrong, I think. But that's part of what we do as humans trying to talk about God.
I love the way you think, Erin, and that you're challenging those nuances. And I will say, I'm just going to put it out there, our bias, people have heard us say, and in my own story, I committed early on that if I was going to have children, and we waited a while because we knew the responsibility, and we didn't know if we would be able to have biological children. We had lots of variable options depending on where God took us. But I knew in my heart of hearts that I would be helping families throughout my calling. But I didn't want to help the world and not do a good job in my own home. So that is a bias of what we built Living Wholehearted on. And we help biological, adopted, in lots of different ways. And we work with singles, we work with married. But at the end of the day, we're helping people align their priorities and their calling. So with that said, I love what you're saying, because you're going, hey, if that's not what you're called to, you have to first know that. And I think not to just absorb or buy a cultural expectation around you. And so you're helping people to slow down for their own walk, as well as those in the community to say, hey, let's quit marginalizing and ostracizing and using this off-putting language, being more thoughtful as communities and kingdom-minded people. So speak a little bit about being on both sides of the coin now, being, you call, child-free and very intentional. The two of you were very intentional. And then having your own kids through foster and adoption, if I'm hearing the story right.
Yes.
Has that changed your perspective at all? Or do you feel very similar? Give us that perspective.
I love how you make my points sound much more coherent than they sound coming out of my mouth. What a gorgeous summary. Yes. So as this person now who has, as I like to call it, a dual perspective, and I often think of it as like, I don't really belong in either group. I don't really feel a sense of belonging with my friends, not completely. I don't feel a complete sense of belonging with my friends who are still childless or child-free. I don't feel a complete sense of belonging with my friends who are mothering and have children under their roof. And I hope that that sense of not belonging gives me the perspective of being able to see something other than sides. That actually there is a lot of things that are happening in all of these communities, and specifically these communities of women, where there's just a lot of feelings of shame and judgment, no matter what,
yes,
life choice or lack of choice you had and the reality that you find yourself in. There are a million ways to be unacceptably female in this country and in the church. And so I think, I hope that my dual perspective gives me the ability in this book in particular to say, look, these scripts aren't working for anyone. Or maybe they're working for a very small subset of people, and good for you. This book isn't going to be your jam. There are other books written for you, and go forth and find them. But if the scripts aren't working for you, if you feel like you're actually not able to show up as fully and honestly and vulnerably and tell your tender, surly truths in the relationships and communities and congregations you find yourself in, it might have something to do with these scripts. And it might have something to do with what you said about rewriting them, learning to rewrite them in a way that feels faithful to you. And so I always say, like, we co-author our stories. I don't think we're like the capital A author, but we get to co-author some of these stories, and we get to like write our smaller story within the cosmic story that we find compelling. I still find the Christian story really compelling. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I am a practicing Christian. I go to church. My pastor's child-free. A lot of the women I interviewed for the book are still practicing Christians and learning, okay, how do we take these texts and interpret them, not just for me, but for all women? And beyond that, men and non-binary folk and creation, like our non-human kin, like how do we have a theology of parenting and family and purpose and human flourishing that's actually big enough to include us all? And that's what I tried to do with the book. I tried to write a book that was big enough to include me, someone who doesn't really know where they fit, but knows that she belongs.
Hmm. So Erin, I mean, you talk a little bit about, like, you know, we co-author. We get to co-author our scripts, if you will. How would you encourage the church, or what are some of the scripts that you might have reframed to give us a broader, a more accurate theology as it relates to some of these themes? That I just think that if we don't think about them with intention, we're just absorbing them, right? And you're calling us to really think about a more holistic and accurate biblical script. So can you provide us some examples that may be just obvious to you, but that could help our listening audience take some ground in this area?
Okay, so there are three I'm going to try to mention really quickly. So one of the scripts is, it'll be different when you have your own. And the rewrite I offer is it's extraordinary who can become your own. So we often use that to communicate that, like, oh, when you have children that come out of your womb, you will have a different relationship to them than you do the neighbor's child that sits on your porch. But maybe we've just had too limited an idea. And again, I think Christianity has a really beautiful theology of adoption, not just legal adoption, which is complicated and problematic at times, but spiritual adoption, how we can make people our own who our culture might not think is a good fit, an easy match, a natural sibling, a natural child or parent, but that actually that's that's what I love best about the upside down story of Jesus, is that we make improbable kin. I forget who said it, but I saw the quote somewhere that if your family doesn't surprise other people, you're doing it wrong. The contrarian in me really likes that. I don't want to say that like you're definitely doing it wrong if you look like other families in your neighborhood. But yeah, I think that's one of them that the Christian story has a lot to speak into. Mm-hmm. Another script I'll just briefly mention is family is your greatest legacy. And my rewrite is like, oh, but legacy is actually so much sweeter than DNA. And I mean that in a very cheeky way, because I really think Jesus in his farewell address, especially the one in John, where he talks about, listen, your sole purpose is just to abide. Like, I'm abiding in God, you abide in me. This is how it works. Life is not about how you make your mark. It's about who you will allow yourself to be marked by. And if you're marked by me, your life will be marked by rest, and your life will be, you know, marked by integrity, because you will be living so close to the vine that your work will naturally be fruitful. You don't have to worry about like going out and making something of yourself. You don't have to produce or reproduce anything to have worth in this economy. And I think that's a real radical reframe for Americans in particular, but Christians too, who often want to like prove how good and hashtag blessed we are. Yeah. By what our families look like or by our accomplishments. And then I the last one.
I was just going to say, to add to your, what your life will be marked on, what the scriptures are clear about. And we might want to add the fact Jesus said that your life will be marked also by suffering.
Yeah.
That's an all-time.
No. Yeah. I'm more into rest than suffering, but you're right. You're right. And then the last one, the mother of all mother scripts, as I like to say, is, you don't know love until you become a mother. Mm. And one, I just find that really offensive to people that aren't parents, to say that they are living a shallow, almost like prepubescent version of humanity. But also on the other side, mother love is not the greatest love I've ever experienced. And I think that I'm not even that interested in creating a hierarchy out of my loves. There are seasons where love feels different to me. There are seasons when I know different things about different people, about myself. And that really, when it comes down to it, my reframe for that script is, I think there are limitless ways to love to your limit. And I think when parents say that, when they say like you don't know love until you have a child of your own or become a parent, they're speaking to this like multiplication of love they felt when they became a parent, but it's not limited to them. And that's where I think they get confused, because they're doing this really impossibly beautiful, hard, holy thing. They're feeling very limited, and therefore they're getting like this sense that like, wow, I'm so small in the scheme of things, and this love I have is so precious and big in comparison. But I think anytime we come up against our limits, anytime we do something that's too big to go it alone, but too worthy not to go it at all, we experience a multiplication of love. We experience what it feels like to be small in the face of something much larger than who we are. And I think parenting is a reliable way to do that, but it's not the only way. And I certainly think that if you look at the famous, you know, baseball park scripture, like, for God so loved the world that he sent his only son, people argue, well, doesn't that prove that parental love like is the highest form of godly love that we can imagine? And I'm like, you're forgetting that it says God so loved the world, God sent his only son. Like, actually, I really think other love was privileged above parent love. And again, I'm just a human trying to make sense of these like very, very big ideas that are bigger than I can fully untangle. But I do think there's so much promise in Christian scripture for a life that really celebrates love in all of its forms, and that keeps coming back to love that is expansive, love that is democratic, love that excludes no one. It would never look at someone else and say, you don't know love because you haven't had this one experience.
Thank you, Erin. I love your critical thinking, your poetic way of really connecting us to the heart of Jesus. And I am so excited, actually, about the geeking out that you do so that others can start to think a little bit more in how we're leading, discipling, shepherding, and walking alongside in our own communities and our cultures that we're called to. And so, fantastic. Where can people find your resources so that those that are like, I need more, where do they go?
So the book, Someone Other Than a Mother, you can get wherever books are sold, your favorite independent bookstore, online, borrowed from the library, whatever your preference is. I also have a website, erinslane.com, that is the amalgamation of all the work I do in the world, both as a writer and a vocational facilitator. And I have a newsletter on Substack that's called Good For You, where we celebrate the less shiny bits of a life well-lived. So less marriage, motherhood, and mortgages. More, yay, you named your need today with joy and freedom. Good for you.
You're cracking me up.
Amen. I love this. This is so good.
So and spicy and sarcastic. I love this.
It is. It is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. And I just selfishly would love for us to end with a sneak peek in what it's like to walk with Parker Palmer. So feel free to brag, but what has been like one of the greatest gifts of being mentored by him?
Oh, you know, I was just Zooming with him a couple of weeks ago, and his intellectual curiosity and desire to sit at the feet of young people, and I'm 38, so not that young, but is really like exactly the elder energy I need and want to embody when I'm his age. And I don't want my life to be smaller and smaller and more insular and insular the older I get. I want to do what he's doing, which is to keep expanding, keep learning, and keep, you know, mastering some technological feats. So we will see. But he's a good, he's a really good model, really good saint for me.
Beautiful. Thank you. And we just are thankful that you're with us every week at the Living Wholehearted Podcast. If you like what you're hearing and we want others to hear, leave us a review. That always lets Jeff and I know how we're doing and what you're enjoying and not liking. And it helps other people find us. And we just are grateful for all of you who are on the journey with us to shrink the gap between what we preach and how we actually are living.
This podcast is powered by Living Wholehearted, Courageous Girls, and the Christian Parenting Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us in this critical movement of shrinking our integrity gaps between what we preach and live.